KQED.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels, in for Michael Krasny. 6 years ago, San Franciscan Dave Eggers wrote a book that received loud praise, a heartbreaking work of staggering genius called Remarkable by the New York Times. Now Eggers has a new book, a fictionalized autobiography of a young refugee from Sudan. The book is called What is the What? A dramatic and heartbreaking story of survival against terrible odds. We'll talk to Dave Eggers about his book and his attempt to teach writing to some of San Francisco's children here on Forum, and you can join us right after this. Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels. Michael Krasny is away. When Dave Eggers' first major book came out 6 years ago, a heartbreaking work of staggering genius, it got laudatory reviews and climbed onto the bestseller list. It was a personal story of Eggers' own family. His parents died within weeks of each other, and he, as a child himself, had to parent his 8-year-old brother. Now Eggers has written another personal tale, but it's not exactly about him. The new book is called What is the What, and it's billed as a novel, the autobiography of Valentino Achak Deng. Much of it, however, is true. The story of a young Sudanese boy caught in the terrifying conflicts in his home country and in the places to which he and thousands of other so-called lost boys flee. Dave Eggers is by choice a San Franciscan, having grown up in Illinois. He is the founder of McSweeney's, an independent publishing house that produces McSweeney's, a monthly journal, and some other publications. And he teaches writing to young children and teenagers at a tutoring center and school he founded 4 years ago called 826 Valencia. Welcome to Forum, Dave Eggers.
Thank you.
And also with us by telephone is the subject of the autobiography, Valentino Achak Deng, who's in Pennsylvania. Welcome to you.
Thank you for having us on KQED.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah.
So let's start with Dave Eggers. This is billed as a novel, but is it really a novel?
Well, there were a lot of parts that had to be reconstructed or fictionalized. The book starts when Valentino is about 6 or 7 years old. The first flashback is when he's a very young boy, and Valentino's memory wasn't complete when it came to that period of time. And also, early on in the process of writing this, we've been working on it for almost 4 years, we realized that to have dialogue at all and to reconstruct, you know, moments and that sort of a thing, we had to call it a novel, to put anything within quotes. If you don't have a tape recorder, that's the way that I was trained as a journalist. If you don't have it on tape, you can't put it within quotes. So
you call it a novel, but in truth, it's very much true.
It's very close to Valentino's story, but there were also parts where we wanted to cover the whole scope of the civil war in Sudan, the one that went from 83 to 2005, and between the north and the south. There were a lot of parts that he wasn't necessarily there at a certain point, but we wanted to cover that part, and so we would weave in a character that had seen, you know, a certain battle or a certain massacre, and he hadn't necessarily been there. So there were, it's a historical novel is the closest comparison to, you know, to, we wanted to cover the whole scope of the war, whether or not he was necessarily there at that moment of time.
Valentino, tell us how old you are today.
I am 25 years old.
So the story is 19 years in the making, in a way.
Of course, and everything in the story is very close to the truth. Many things in the books are somewhat different than what happened in real life. Some characters have been combined. Some time is compressed. There are minor things, but they were necessary. They were really necessary. For one thing, I was very young when the book begins, so I could not remember conversations and small details from my early childhood in Morel Bay. It was necessary to construct the chronology, and that was what Dave did.
Well,
he took the basic facts and then created the story from there.
Dave, let's talk just a little bit about the story and summarize it briefly. I mean, it starts, other than the opening scene, which is in an apartment in America where Valentino is being robbed by two African-American, a couple, but it starts in Sudan. And what happens, if we can summarize it briefly so we know what we're talking about here?
Well, everything that we read about now that's going on in Darfur, where these militias are armed and aided and abetted and condoned by the Sudanese government, where these militias will go in and they'll raid a town, they will rape, pillage, kill, burn the town to the ground, steal what they want.
This is the Janjaweed.
This is the Janjaweed. And the same militias, in some cases the exact same men, and the same militias were operating in southern Sudan since 1983, '84, '85. They were just called the Murhaleen then. They were that's what they were known as then. So it's been the same method where Sudanese government to punish any sort of uprisings. And in the case of the South, it was the SPLA, the Sudan People's Liberation Army. They rose up against the government and rebelled a little bit in the early 80s. And the government, to punish the entire South, to catch a fish, drain a pond, they unleashed these militias and told them to do what they wanted to do, to destroy villages, livelihoods, everything, to punish the people that were, supposedly complicit in aiding the rebels.
But your book is not necessarily a political book. It's more of a personal journey story.
It's supposed to, I think we set out to sort of tell the story of one man and his life, but by doing so, illuminate the history of the conflict in Sudan.
And Valentino was not alone, of course. There were, tens of thousands of these boys who were trying to escape from this terrible situation?
Yeah, Valentino, you want to tell that part of the story?
The entire region was subjected to the complete unrest, and every village, every town in Sudan was subject to aerial bombardments, underground attack, and areas that were at the border with the north had to face heavy assaults from northern tribes that were mobilized by the governments, and were permitted to do whatever they could in the south. And, thousands of people in the south were subjected to all of the atrocities beginning from 1983 to 2005, when the governments of Sudan and the Southern Sudan's People Liberation Movement signed a peace agreement. So there was me and other thousands of boys who are currently known in the United States as the Lost Boys of Sudan, who were in that situation.
And they, thousands of these boys were directed to Ethiopia to seek sanctuary there, where the rebel army was stationed and where they would train. And so the boys were sent to Ethiopia, partly to escape the war, and partly to, eventually, many of the boys were trained as soldiers, and they went to school, but many of them made up the next wave of the SPLA army.
And getting to Ethiopia was no picnic.
It wasn't at all. The moment you leave your village, 2 weeks later, you realize that you are up to a certain changes in your life, and you have to live up to those challenges. It wasn't a picnic.
The challenges were varied, but they were all pretty horrible. Reading the book, you confront things that people in this country have never had to confront, including lions in the bush.
Absolutely. That was the lessons and the price to pay for the war. There was so much of ethnic cleansing campaign across the regions where the governments armed certain tribes to target certain tribes, and where there were so many other factions in southern Sudan. And then the boys who didn't know or who weren't supportive of different factions, we didn't know what was happening, become victims of that. And of course, we faced starvations, and we have to feed on almost anything that we could find edible to eat, and face diseases and wild animals and death due to diseases and other illnesses.
You know, the boys walked, by Valentino's estimate, about 800 miles barefoot and walking and walked to Ethiopia. And, you know, for every 100 or so boys, there was probably one adult who would guide them. And in many cases, those adults would come and go. And so by most estimates, thousands of boys died along the way just to make it to Ethiopia.
And this was after their parents were either killed or removed, or nobody knew where they were. So what struck me was that these kids had to face more than just a wild animal in the bush. They had to face death on all sides, and it was just a horrendous experience that's almost unimaginable.
Val, can you talk about, tell us about what it's like to walk, you know, to an unknown place you've never heard of, and you don't even know what the fate of your parents and village?
After a few days, when one is separated from the family and you just working with an elderly person who is guiding you to go to Ethiopia or to Kenya, you know, we kind of, for example, I kind of lost the sense, because initially I thought that I would be able to get settled after 2 or 3 weeks, but then 3 weeks becomes a month, and then a month, 2 months, and 3 months, and I was lost in the journey. You know, I was like, if I go back, I wouldn't be able to go to my home, because now I don't know where my home is, and I don't know where the final destinations or how long it will take me to arrive there is. So it becomes a sense where we were going east, and every other day we wake up and work. Some days you go toward the sunrise, the next days you go toward the sunset, and it was at all, you know, the hopeless situations.
Well, I'm kind of curious when you say hopeless. I mean, it sounds pretty hopeless. I'm wondering what your attitude was as you were walking along, probably not knowing if you were going to survive another day.
I began the journey thinking that I was going to a safe place where I would wait and then get back to my family. But then as the journey took longer, I came to realize that I have to take certain things at my hand. I have to take responsibility of myself. I have to prevail. I have to have hope, and I must strive, you know, for tomorrow and tomorrow. And then I must help my friends who is with me in the journey. And that which was also supported by the Sudanese elders who were with us. They would give us speeches every morning and at night when we go to bed. For example, when someone died, then they would call a meeting and say, that happened, but that is not all of you. You have to be strong. You have to have hope that tomorrow you will get into a better place. And then when you are there, you will be able to come back to your country and save your people. This is not you alone suffering. The entire country, the entire region is subjected to these atrocities, and you are the future. So that teachings gave me a lot of hopes and energy, and I felt myself as someone who must resist that pain to be somebody in the future.
Let me remind our audience, we're talking with Dave Eggers, whose new book is What is the What? It's the fictionalized autobiography of Valentino Acek-Deng, who we're also talking with. It's a new book. What attracted you, Dave, to the story? Was it the plight of Sudan as a political problem? Was it the individual trials of Valentino? Was it the human condition? What got you involved?
I would think all of those things that you named, for sure. I had read about the Lost Boys of Sudan first in the New York Times Magazine, ran a piece about them, and then after that I was very, I read everything I could. It was just such an intriguing story. When 4,000 of these Lost Boys had been resettled from the Kakuma refugee camp in northwest Kenya and resettled in cities and towns all over the U.S., and that happened in 2000, 2001. And I had been reading and following this story about their readjustment to life here, and sometimes they were in very incongruous places like Fargo and, you know, very cold climates, and they were getting used to life here and struggling with that and sometimes having triumphs. And around when I was very aware of this story, I got a letter in the mail from Mary Williams, who is the head of the Lost Boys Foundation in Atlanta, and she had set up this foundation to aid the readjustment and the resettlement of these young men in the Atlanta area, because there were about 180 Lost Boys there. And she wrote me a letter just out of the blue saying that she knew a young man named Valentino. At the time, he was going by the name Dominic. That's another long story. But that he was one of the leaders of the young men, that he spoke a lot about the plight of the Sudanese to churches and student groups in and around Atlanta. He was sort of a spokesman, and he wanted to write his story. And she had read my memoir and thought maybe I would be a good match to sort of mentor him in terms of, like, writing this story. And so I just based on this letter, I just went out to Atlanta to meet with him. I wasn't sure what we would do, that we, you know, if I would just be helping in some way or what. And Valentino and I spent a weekend together just going through the story and recording it. And it became clear that, you know, he wanted me to write his story. And so that began a very long journey of about 4 years of sort of getting it down and shaping it and going back to Sudan in 2003 to research the book and go back to his village. And our hope all along was to sort of, illuminate what's happening in Sudan so that and humanize it, because I think, and take it just from apart from just the headlines and things that we hear about atrocities, and say, and illuminate it through Valentino's eyes and life.
You want to illuminate it because it's a great story, because it's an interesting novel, because you're crusading to bring this onto the radar screen, the whole situation in Sudan.
I think all of those things. I think that it's hard for people when they read these headlines and they read little newspaper bits. Well, another 10,000 people might have been killed in Darfur or now in Chad, and nobody's doing anything about it. And maybe the UN meets about it and they ask to send peacekeepers, and then Sudan government says no, we don't want the peacekeepers, and then that's that. And I think that this has been going on for 3 years now. And it was going on for 20 years in southern Sudan, the same sorts of atrocities. And the fact that the international community sort of isn't able to put anything effective together to stop this is infuriating. And I think that hearing the full story of Valentino's life, and through that understanding the mechanisms that put all this in place and the workings of the Sudanese government and their tactics, might help people understand what's going on there, and might see, might be able to humanize the problem a little bit, and maybe people would be more moved to do something about it.
Valentino, we've heard stories from Sudan many times on television, on the NewsHour, in the newspapers, and it's never particularly clear who is fighting for what. It's a power struggle. It's angry. But there doesn't seem to be any principles particularly involved. And you rarely get to hear from anybody who's there who speaks English. You're usually hearing this through a reporter who's gone there for a few days or a few weeks. Most of the people there don't speak English. So it's a chance right now for me to ask you, what is this battle in the Sudan about?
In the past, I didn't know what the battle was about, because as a child, and then my village one day sort of was attacked and burned 3 times before I left the village. And then in Ethiopia, in the refugee camps and in Kakuma, I questioned myself, what is the conflict in Sudan about? And individually, I have come to realize that most of it is about retaining power.
And retaining power, for the government wants to retain power?
Yes, because every successive government in Sudan has committed atrocities.
It's been explained sometimes as Arabs not trying to hurt people who are not Arabs. Is that part of the story?
Most of the politicians who have ruled Sudan time and often have always used the policy of ethnic cleansing, setting north against the south, just for them to gain support. For example, before war, my father was a businessman, and he had many Arabs and Islamic friends who come to my home and live with us and do their trades, and my dad go to the north. And only after the war began later did this turn into the war that is called Jihad against the Sub, killing of the infidels in the Sub. And from there I lost the point. Why would someone from the north come in the names of Islam and in the names of Arabs to kill me, while yesterday they were my father's friends? And then why is every government committing the same atrocities in the north and even now in Darfur? What is the problem that ended up to the power struggle? Politicians in Sudan want to grab power. It doesn't matter if it is in the north, in Darfur, in southern Sudan. They need power, and to retain that, they have to set peoples against one another in Sudan.
Dave Eggers, you agree? Is there an answer to this question?
Yeah, well, you know, the government of Sudan is, they don't have wide popular support across the country. There are all kinds of factions, Arab and non-Arab factions, that do not approve of these policies. And so they're held in power by, I think, to some degree, the complicity of the international community that doesn't impose any sanctions on them, any effective sanctions. We're trying to do constructive engagement with this murderous government that's been, you know, committing atrocities for decades now. And a lot of it has to do with oil. A lot of it has to do with intelligence. Right now, that there's a trade happening where ever since 9/11, the Sudanese government has been handing over intelligence information based on the fact that they harbored al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden in the 90s, and they have a lot of information about these terrorists or supposed terrorists. And so the government says the CIA is very finds them very useful, so we don't want to impose too strong sanctions on them lest we lose that intelligence information.
All right, well, we're talking with Dave Eggers, who's the author of a new book called What is the What? And it's the autobiography, but it's fictionalized, of Valentino Acek Deng, who is also with us on the phone today from Pennsylvania. We're going to find out what happened to him in the second part of this show, and we'd like to take your calls. If you want to talk to Dave Eggers about this book or his previous books, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us at forum@kqed.org. So we'll continue our discussion in just a little while after the break. I'm Spencer Michaels, and this is Forum from KQED FM. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels, in for Michael Krasny. We're talking with Dave Eggers, the author of What is the What?, his new book about Sudan, and a young man named Valentino Acek Deng, who is also with us on the telephone from Pennsylvania today, and you've probably heard the run-up to this. But I want to, Dave, before we get to some telephone calls, let's try one more time to summarize the setting in Sudan. Why are people like Valentino getting caught up in a situation they don't understand at all? What are the dynamics of this problem in the Sudan?
A really general, simple way to look at it is that different rebel groups, starting in the early 80s and now in Darfur, have risen up against the government, demanding more representation in the government, in Khartoum, sharing of resources, sharing of oil wealth, that sort of a thing. And to punish these rebel groups, the government unleashes these militias, the Janjaweed or the Mujahideen, to wreak havoc, to kill at will, and thus discourage any rebellion, discourage any sort of voices against the ruling power regime in the future. So that's the simple version of it.
The Sudan seems like a terribly poor country. Not a lot of resources there, particularly, though you mentioned oil.
Oh, yeah. The northern ruling elite in Sudan is getting quite wealthy right now because they found oil in the late 70s in a region that's disputed, right in the middle of the country between north and south. Chevron found oil, some say with the help of George Bush Sr.
Is that the real goal here? Is that what they're fighting over?
Well, not in Darfur. There's no oil over there
no.
to speak of, but that's really just to punish the people for demanding a voice in their government.
Of course, the people, some of them, like Valentino, didn't even know that he was being punished for that.
Of course, thousands, hundreds of thousands. And the same thing with the people of Darfur. They're not. You know, there's a small group called the Justice and Equality Movement, which was the main rebel group in Darfur that rose up in 1983. And for that, millions are punished and displaced. But then it's sort of turned into an ethnic cleansing operation where the Arab militias are trying to get rid of the people that are non-Arabs, or so they say.
You know, the story in What is the What, the journey that Valentino makes, the hardships along the way, even the hardships when he gets to America, are fairly depressing to some extent. I mean, the fact that he gets through them is uplifting, but it's not a terribly easy read. You have to want to read this because there's so many bad things that happen. Did you have a hard time selling the book, or actually your own company published it,
yeah.
McSweeney's?
No, you know, I will say, because we made every effort to make it a readable book and also include all the aspects of Valentino's life and anyone's life. There's a lot of happiness, there's romance, there's a lot of humor, I think. All of these things that make up a complete life. And Valentino's life has been amazing in every aspect. And so we tried not to just go from calamity to calamity, even though his life has been fraught. Wouldn't you say, Val?
Yeah.
Valentino, are you there?
I am there.
did the book soft pedal the horror of the journey, or were there some pretty inspiring moments?
The book is the microcosm of the conflict in Sudan, as well as the afterlife that many Sudanese and me as an example faced. But it is important to note that many parts of the book that seemed most incredible are the ones that are truth. I grew up in different refugee camps and have interacted with many people in East Africa and have had fun as well. It was not just about atrocities that I had to go through. I also had good life. And through the process of the book, there's some time where I write something that I didn't want to write, and because Dave wanted me to write about it, then I came to realize, oh, I really had fun here, and I was a young man here, a young boy, you know, with young girls here and there, and had that fun. But in most part, the book is the book that will help people understand about Sudan and why the conflicts continue there. Perhaps people will read this and understand more about the Darfur, because the situation in Darfur is not any different from the situation in Sudan that happened within last 23 years. It is the same government militia that has only changed the name. It is the same government diplomats and rulers that has changed parties, but their principles had been the same, excluding southern Sudanese and southern Sudan from the political, social, and economic life of the country, as well as Darfur. So it is not any difference. And if anyone would like to understand more about Sudan from a civilian point of view, like me, this is the book that will give them more information.
All right. We're going to take a call from Ellen in San Jose. Just parenthetically, if you want to contact us, we're at 866-733-6786 if you want to call into forum or email us at forum@kqed.org. I've got a very interesting email here, which I'll get to in a minute. But first, Ellen, hi, you're on forum.
Hi, thank you so much. And thank you, Valentino, for sharing your story and Dave for writing it. I've worked with refugees for the last 25 years, and it's just an exquisite book. I wanted you, if you could, to speak to the issue of material support and how that is impacting the refugee program, so that someone like Valentino, as a result of the Real ID and Patriot Act, would no longer be admitted to the U.S. refugee program.
What do you mean material support?
The material support clause is a clause in the both the Patriot and the Real ID Act that says that if someone ever provided material support, so that if someone were raped by the rebels and then were forced to feed them, they would no longer be admitted to the U.S. refugee program. And for certain, it is affecting the lost boys in Kakuma, without a doubt. So those people that would at one point have been admitted to the U.S. refugee program are no longer being admitted to the U.S. refugee program. This year, we admitted 23,000 refugees, which is the smallest amount we've admitted to the country except for right after 9/11, because of the material support clause and how it's being interpreted.
Dave, you have a comment on that?
You know, Valentino has the most interesting story because he was one of the last groups that was admitted, of Lost Boys for some time, that was admitted right after 9/11. Valentino, you want to tell that story?
Yeah, I think it's important to notice here that once one leaves the country, and I'm giving this example on the Sudanese views, it's not that you don't like your country, and it's not that everything is not good in your country. One has the part that you support and the part that you don't support. For example, when I left southern Sudan, I knew that my people, including my family, was going to get killed. If I am in the refugee camp and there is a way I could help that family, I wouldn't refrain from doing that. And for someone who want to help me, who want to give me a durable solutions in the name of resettlement to a third country, if they rejected me, if they deny me a chance to come to the United States because for some reason they find out that I have supported somebody that is supporting my country, I think that would not be fair. It's okay, by law I will not be allowed to come, but as human being, there is no way I would enjoy life. For example, I go to restaurants in the United States, eat and throw away enough food without thinking about someone who is starving in any region that I come from.
Well, it's also, if I can add, what he mentioned that some of the most incredible parts of the book are those that might seem fictionalized, but they're true. And Valentino, when he was being resettled, his flight from Kakuma and then from Nairobi to New York, he was on a plane on 9/11 and was pulled off the plane when news of the attacks came to Nairobi. And so they had a few weeks in limbo in Nairobi when they didn't think that they would ever be brought to the U.S. And after that, it was extraordinarily difficult for many years for any of those refugees from Kakuma to be brought over, in part because what Ellen was talking about. And also, all of the different restrictions after the Patriot Act.
One of the things, of course, Valentino did make it to America. You've been here several years now. Your English is impeccable. So we have an email from Dave who says, please ask Valentino to describe if and how he relates to American blacks. And that's actually part of the book. That's talked about quite a bit in the book. You want to try that one, Valentino?
How I relate to the American blacks?
Mm-hmm.
I consider all Americans as Americans. And I have come to this country believing that this is my new country. Everyone who lives here is my is going to be my friend, is going to be my fellow countrymen in a few months. And I have no differentiations between the American blacks and the American Caucasians. And I'm a black, like the American black. That's how I look at myself.
But the book opens in an apartment in Atlanta, I believe, and two people come into your apartment and rob you and beat you up. And this is factual. This is not fiction. They happen to be African Americans, and they call you Africa. That's their name for you. It's a frightening scene and brings up the question, you know, how do you see that, and how do they see you?
I saw those who attacked me in Atlanta as criminals, and that is true of any society. If you fall into the hand of the criminals, you become their targets, and you become somebody that they want to get something from. These were people I have never known in my life, but they tricked me by asking me to give them my cell phone, and then at the end I realized that my help was my problem. So I looked at them as the people I did not know and criminals. Yeah, I didn't look at them based on their race or based on my origin from Africa. Of course, if someone sees me and then think that I'm an immigrant and I do not know about life here and I'm naive, they will trick me, and that happened because of my belief that if someone asks me for something that I am able to give, why would I deny them? And I gave my cell phone, and that was the problem. And from that day on, I came to know that there are criminals everywhere. And if they don't know of your background, and criminals don't even want to know the background of the person they are targeting.
It's easier that way, I suppose.
Yeah.
Not to know your victim. Well, that's interesting, and I've got some more questions to that, but let's take another phone call. Tim is on the phone from Shreveport, Louisiana. Hello, Tim.
Yeah, hi. It kind of defies all logic how human beings can grow to a population that cannot feed itself, but just about how many people were there before this cleansing, ethnic cleansing started, and how many people are alive now, and is the population continuing to grow? I mean, are women still pregnant? I mean, are births still happening as the slaughter goes on? And I'll take my answer off. Thanks.
Thank you very much. That's interesting. Some statistics, if you've got some, Dave, on what's going on.
Well, it depends on if you're talking about Southern Sudan or Northern Sudan. I think the number that most people agree on is that about 2.5 million people were killed or died as a result of lack of medicine, medical care, starvation, a number of things that are war-related in the war between the North and the South.
Including murder?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, through an armed conflict between the two and the many different factions within the rebel army, actually, at the time. But that would be the war that ended in 2005. In Darfur, the number right now, I think, is about 300,000 dead and 2 million displaced. Isn't that about right, Valentino?
Yeah, in southern Sudan, 2.5 million people have died before the international community, and especially with the help from the United States.
2.5 million people?
2.5 million people.
Out of a population of approximately what?
The Sudanese population was about 36,000 before war.
36 million, you mean?
36 million before war. And then right now, I don't know the current statistics, but in southern Sudan, 2.5 million have died within 23 years of war between North and the South. And then later on, after peace talks, the population of southern Sudan is estimated to be more than 12 million right now. And there are 4 million Sudanese in exile in Africa.
In Africa.
Excluding those who came to the Western Wall for refugee programs.
Well, while we're there, while we're talking about people who came to the Western world, fill us in on what you are doing today and what you've been doing for the last couple of years. I mean, you came to this country You didn't speak English at all, did you? Or you did speak English?
I did speak English, and I hope that my primary goal for this book is for it to help people understand Sudan and why the conflicts continue there. It is not just about the conflict in Darfur, the conflict in Sudan. There was a war before the modern Southern-North War, and it has all been about the Sudanese government, successive Sudanese government neglecting Southern Sudanese the Sudan regions.
Well, hey, Val, do you want to talk about what you're doing now?
Yeah, and what I hope to do right now, like the proceeds from the book will do great things in Southern Sudan. I have many plans for my home village, and there will be a library there and a youth center and a women's gender program center, because women have been the primary victims of every war. And in a male-dominated society like Sudan, men begin the war and women suffer.
Wow.
And many things that are needed there, we will begin very soon with the programs, and I hope to go to Southern Sudan next summer.
Now, when you left Sudan, you came to Atlanta. You wanted to go to college. That didn't happen really easily, did it?
It didn't happen. It took me long because for one reason I started as being an advocate. I was sure that the international community was not allowed to access many information from the South. Media didn't do good coverage of North-South war. And if I come here as a victim of that war, I have to be the voice of those people. And I did that for a while. Then it was difficult getting to college within the first 2 years because I have to be a permanent resident to get in-state tuitions. And then we started the process of the book, and I enrolled at Georgia Perimeter College where I took some English courses. And then later on, I am now a student at Allegheny College in Pennsylvania. And it's a good college, wonderful college, and I hope to get my degree here.
In what subject?
In international diplomacy and world affairs.
Wow.
Yeah.
Dave, you wanted to comment?
I was just going to say that, you know, the Lost Boys, many, a good majority of them came here with dreams of college, and the problem was they were given 3 months of aid, and then they were on their own. And so most of them, including Valentino, had to take full-time jobs being paid anywhere from $6 to $9 an hour, and Valentino worked years first at Best Buy in the back room, and then as a fabric sample filer at a furniture showroom, and that makes going to college very difficult when you have to pay the rent and everything else. So it took Valentino, who, as we can, you know, was like a leader of these of the Lost Boys and hell bent on going to college. It took him 5 years.
And is his story atypical or somewhat typical of those who finally made it to this country?
Val, what do you think?
This is a story of my life as well as a microcosm of what many Sudanese immigrants are facing in the United States. You would see that there are jobs problems, there are integrations problems. It's not very easy for people to adapt into a new life. Within the first few years, I found it difficult myself and many Sudanese immigrants and maybe other immigrants in the U.S. go through these processes. So it takes a while, and it's there are expectations when one hears from Africa or anywhere that you're going to the United States. And sometimes when you get here and you realize that not all of your expectations are going to be met immediately, then people wonder, some people panic, and it becomes a struggle that one has to move from here and there to straighten his life.
All right. Let's take a call now from Steve in San Francisco. I find that many of our callers and some of the comments deal with the politics of the situation as opposed to the personal stories, which is kind of interesting. Steve, go ahead. You're on forum.
Yes, it's a privilege to speak to this noble man, and you and Dave Eggers are wonderfully committed, and I'm sorry it's been so hard for you. One reason that I think cynicism can creep in so easily is we have what I think is called a African National Congress, which you would think would know the situation there, be able to evaluate it more objectively, less people in between the real story and the media story over here. And the fact that that organization, plus the United Nations, with I guess the support of the head of the rock band U2, are trying to highly publicize these stories, but they still don't seem to, as you said earlier, get traction. What can be done? Why not? What can be done? That's probably much easier to say. Why is it not being done through the United Nations, with the head of the organization from Africa, about to lose his post at the end of the year, I believe? I know he doesn't want this to be a legacy in the negative sense.
You ask some very deep questions that I don't know that there are any great answers for, but we can try. Thank you very much, Steve. What do you think, Dave?
I take my cue from John Prendergast, who's, I think, one of the world's foremost experts on Sudan and an advisor to Valentino and I and this book. He's at the International Crisis Group, and he says, there are specific things. There is that intelligence trade-off where the CIA is actually backing off because they think that we're getting a lot of good information about terrorists. I think that's an unfair and a horrible trade-off to be made, that we're looking a blind eye to the atrocities because we value their intelligence. I think that the U.S. brokered the peace between North and South in 2005, Condi Rice and Colin Powell and the Bush administration, with some pushing from the evangelical base here in the U.S., said this war has to stop. They saw it as a war between Islam and Christianity, and they said, let's help and broker this peace. Well, they can put the same sort of pressure on Khartoum that they did then. There should be sanctions. There should be constructive sanctions.
Should there be military action?
No, I don't think it's needed. You have these militias. There should be U.N. peacekeepers, and they should be imposed.
I think the specter of Somalia has infected the United States
absolutely.
A great deal.
Absolutely. That's part of it, but it needn't be that. I think that if you target the ruling elite in Khartoum, they all have these shadow companies that they operate and that they're sharing all this oil wealth. If you target them, freezing assets, economic sanctions, naming names, turning over intelligence to the ICC for war crimes indictments, all of these things, and if you make it a pariah state and these ruling elites themselves pariahs, then things will happen. And you need to get very serious and specific about it. And I think that too many people are turning a blind eye. And part of the UN Security Council is because China and Malaysia and Russia are using the oil. And so they don't want to be unfriendly to Khartoum. So there's a lot of different things happening. Val, do you agree?
I agree. This is the government that is led by many smart gentlemen who would commit atrocities and get away from it. And I heard they have seen the international, made the people who commit atrocities in Africa pay the price of what they have done. The civilians always remain the victims during peace or during wartime. Take, for example, in Darfur, the situation continues because those guys too motivated the situation on the ground aren't targeted. If you target them, they will know that this is not about Sudan and the war. This is about me now, and they will change their tactics. And maybe they don't support this because they will get benefit of it, but it helped them retain the power, as I said earlier. It's interesting that in southern Sudan, 2.5 million have died, and nobody has paid price for it. It is only the peace agreement that has been signed.
Peter in Mill Valley is on the phone with us. Hi, Peter.
Yes, hello. I would say that what's being presented, I know it's a terrible, terrible tragedy, which has been going on for some time, is somewhat simplistic. Are not the main things behind this actually various Western interests in order to, who wish to exploit the conditions in Sudan as well as the Great Lakes. So, for example, nothing has been mentioned of an even greater tragedy, which is 6 or 7 million that have died in the Congo in the last 8 years or so. So aren't the, and also actually Sudan has not just oil, apparently it's the biggest exporter of the finest quality gum arabic, which is used in drinks, Coca-Cola and so on, which is no small thing. So what I'm saying is that all these depredations, whether it's Rwanda or and so on, or in Uganda with Amin, aren't Western interests really behind and using and manipulating? And when, at the moment, Darfur is flavor of the month, and beforehand it was Rwanda, and what we are presented is a very simplistic, is these are them doing this against those, where in fact it's much more complex than that.
All right, Peter, thank you for your call. We're getting down here to the end, but you want to try that one, Dave, briefly?
Not really. I'm not exactly sure what he was saying. I think that I was trying.
Economic interests are really what's behind all this.
I think if he's saying that it's in the interest of the Western world to foster chaos in Africa for their own economic gain, I don't necessarily buy that. I don't think that their access to even oil is aided by genocide in Darfur.
You know, I think we, rather than leave this whole subject on the political note, the personal note is what makes this a really interesting book and a fascinating read. When Valentino said a few minutes ago, I knew that my family would be killed, he said it so simply and so matter-of-factly. That seems to be the tone of the book and makes the book so readable, is that you're not dwelling on this, but it's there and it's sticking into you. Is that briefly, Dave, what one of the things that intrigued you?
I think it really turned into just a full biography. It's 472 pages about a man's life, everything about it, and he happens to have been wrapped up in the Civil War.
And that's where we'll end it. The book is called What is the What by Dave Eggers, and it's the story of Valentino Acheg-Deng, but it's considered a novel. Thank you very much for being on Forum with us. It's been a fascinating hour, and thank you, Valentino. This is Forum from KQED-FM in San Francisco. I'm Spencer Michaels. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.